We're up to the last item of the day, item number 26, Southern Resident Killer Whale Briefing and Possible Policy Guidance, and Dr. Becker will lead us off on this.
All right, good afternoon, Chair Smith, members of the Commission, Director Storr and Deputy Director Windrup. Good ring to it. I have the distinct pleasure of being your last presentation of the day, so I'll understand if you clap when I'm finished.
You would clap anyhow.
Okay. So the story that I wanted to tell you today is a little refresher on where we're at with killer whales, and then in particular cover the initiative that we're working on linked to the governor's executive order that came out this last month. As a refresher, we have a population in trouble. Our southern resident killer whales were around 70 individuals at the end of the capture era, when many of them went to places like SeaWorld for entertainment purposes. You can see they've fluctuated greatly over time. And at the time of listing, it looked like things were pretty bad, but things have gotten worse over time. The last time I came to you and Gary Wiles gave you a presentation on the periodic status review was in June 2016, when we had 83 animals at that time. We're down to 76 now. At that meeting, I think you maintained the endangered status of the species, and so it kind of highlights that things are not getting better, even in this short amount of time. They're getting much worse. In addition to the population numbers over time, we've got 76 now. We're also looking at issues with body condition and the fact that these animals are really struggling to reproduce successfully. What you're seeing here is some new technology that allows us to use some specialized drones and take photographic images, and then you'll see those yellow lines are essentially some places on the killer whale body that they would measure to look at blubber content and how good body condition is and whether they might be pregnant. They're finding that although some animals are, there's evidence that they're getting pregnant, they're often aborting late in pregnancy, which is really dangerous for females, and then calves that are brought to term are often not viable for very long. So these are pretty bad signs for our population. You hear a lot about killer whales, southern resident killer whales, and people think about Puget Sound. One of the things I wanted to stress to you today is to be thinking about killer whales as a statewide perspective. The summer season, we have killer whales in abundance, and that's when most people see them. In the winter time, one of the pods, J pod, tends to stick pretty close to the Salish Sea, the Strait of Georgia, and then head out to the outer coast a little bit. And in contrast, we have K and L pod that tend to head out to the outer coast and spend a lot more time on at the mouth of our Columbia, as well as near Willapa Bay, and then they can go all the way up to Alaska and down to California too. When they are in Puget Sound, you can see that the numbers show Chinook is very important to them, and as you can see throughout the year, Chinook is really important to killer whales. All of the data that we currently have year-round suggests that Chinook remains important, and when they are switching to other types of prey, there's some hypotheses out there that that's a really bad sign, that that perhaps indicates that they're struggling to find anything at all. And the nutritional quality of Chinook is the highest of many of the things that they eat. So when we're thinking about recovery, we're thinking about Chinook. And on the outer coast, this is relatively new information that we're getting from NOAA. We're seeing that there is a little bit of steelhead in the diet, and then surprisingly things like lingcod and halibut. When you have J-pod especially getting into South Sound in the fall, you'll see that chum is a really big part of their diet, especially recently. And then I'd highlight that especially in, and I believe it's May, steelhead is important to them. in Puget Sound. Why do we love them? I think it's really easy as we're working on killer whale recovery to get people to understand why this is something that we should all be working on together. They're an important part of our heritage and our culture. As far as economics go, we have a huge amount of tourism and advertising around killer whales. $60 million annually is the minimum amount of an estimate that whale watching alone brings to our economy. We can relate to these animals. They're very social in structure. They have tight family bonds. And finally, the biggest reason I think that it's important that we get a lot of folks on board for killer whale recovery is that the killer whales are an indication that something is really wrong. And if we're able to recover killer whales, that means that we're able to recover Chinook salmon, and we're able to get our ecosystem back to a better functioning place. Three major threats are recognized for killer whales. The first and foremost is reduced abundance of salmon. The second is the vessel interactions in sound, which affects how accessible that prey is to them and how much they're able to find that prey. And the chemical contaminants and potential oil spills are also recognized as very important. I would say that on the contaminant side is another thing that is exacerbated by the first one, abundance of salmon. When these whales get skinnier, they tend to use their fat stores, and those contaminants are fat-loving, so they're burning their fat stores and then releasing those contaminants into their bodies, which spells really bad things for things like reproduction. Vessels and noise is recognized as one of the things that we can work on in the short term, where we've been working with our enforcement program and with some outside organizations like Soundwatch on outreach and education. You've heard quite a bit about our enforcement efforts on the water. Those are really key to getting compliance to the whale watching regulations we have that allow us to ensure that the boats are kept a distance away from the whales so that they can properly socialize and to find the prey that's out there. And then shipping is another piece of that. Beyond the smaller recreational boats and whale watchers, the places like Harrow Strait are very busy shipping lanes, and we're learning more and more, especially from stuff in Canada, about how those might be affecting the whales and their ability to hear. Think of, you know, being in a loud concert and that background noise constantly in your ears and trying to key in on noises. They're having to speak louder themselves and struggle to find more prey to the point that there are estimates that they're losing 3 to 5 hours a day of foraging time because of the effects of noise. I talked a little bit about the contaminants piece, and I would say there's a lot of work going on already around this, everything from stormwater and wastewater issues, and ecology is certainly focused on this. In our own department, we've got an oil spill team that is working with a cross-section of other agencies and with NOAA and others on preparations for if we were to have oil spill, how do we keep the whales away from that area? Rehabilitation of these animals is not really an option, so we have to just minimize their ability to be in contact with that. I talked about prey a little bit, and this is one that, of course, WDFW has a major role in helping to alleviate some of these issues. We think about especially the prey item in a short-term, intermediate-term, and long-term ways that we can start to benefit killer whales. We are working on hatchery issues right now. We've had a lot of decreases over time due to some restrictions that were placed upon us, as well as some budgetary cuts. So we're looking at where are the places that the whales will overlap with particular stocks so that we can be strategic in looking at prioritizing where we can put increases that will most benefit the whales and, of course, have some benefits for our fisheries at the same time. That same process of looking at the important stocks for the whales is also going to help us to prioritize where we are doing habitat protection and restoration. So having that landscape level statewide about where are we going to focus on salmon recovery and how we can ramp up efforts in particular areas to benefit the whales specifically will be really important. Hydropower continues to be something that is being worked on, and I think you've all heard about some recent court cases and things going on that will help us hopefully in the future connected to additional spill over the dams that could benefit salmon as well as improved infrastructure at some sites. And finally, predation is something that we're being sure to cover in the spectrum of the prey issue because it's one of the factors that we have some recent evidence that shows that there can be some negative impacts in some places to some fish stocks. So looking at things like protecting and restoring forage fish, it looks like the amount of forage fish available in certain areas affects how much these predators are going to affect our salmon population. So that might be something we can do in the short term. Start working on that. Eliminating some of the easy pickings locations where you have an artificial haul-out site that humans have developed and these seals and sea lions are using them, and those might be some migration corridors specifically that are important to salmon. So if we can look at getting rid of those, that's also helpful. And then if the data shows that we really need to look at lethal removal, like in some cases that we've already done at Bonneville Dam, and looking at feasibility of what that might look like, what would be most effective, and what is scientifically valid for us to move forward with. And lastly, harvest has already significantly declined, but we heard a lot of north of Falcon that we've got a major problem with our stocks as well. That's part of the decline. We're also hearing that the Pacific Salmon Treaty is a part of the solution, hopefully with some reductions in some catch, making it possible that there's some more fish that are going to make it farther down south and the whales will have their shot at it. Canada's proposed some timing and area closures in four different locations that they know to be foraging hotspots for the whales, and those are pending proposals right now. And then Ron talked a little bit this morning about the measures around north of Falcon to benefit killer whales. So the governor's executive order was signed almost exactly a month ago. And in addition to that order, we've also at the same time been working with the governor's office and the legislature on some funding in the short term to benefit killer whales so that we can hit the ground running and start implementing these actions. The executive order itself asked the agency to do some short-term actions, and it instructed us to help establish a task force that would work on actions and funding recommendations to be submitted to him. On the supplemental funding side, we're extremely fortunate that we got several of the things that we thought would be really helpful in the immediate term to benefit killer whales. Those include two new officers that will be able to be focused in, I think, Bellingham and Anacortes, provide additional patrols on the water, which will be great for minimizing the effects of vessels on the whales. We got some money to increase hatchery production and to improve some facilities so that we might ramp up production in some additional areas in the future. We're doing some fish screen inventory and maintenance, and that's not just in Puget Sound. That's even on the east side as well as in Puget Sound. Public outreach and education around this effort, around the vessel regulations, is going to continue to be important. We're going to invest in that with some of the money that we received, continue to coordinate the recovery, and work with the governor's office on this new initiative. We also got a little bit of money that will help us to work on some pinniped predation research and compile some data, as I mentioned before, to really inform where we're headed with our approach on predation of salmonids. And some oil spill protection money. And then finally, we've got a contract with OFM so that the task force that's being built will be facilitated through some monies that flowed through us. The immediate actions went to a multiple state agencies, and here are the ones that had DFW on the list of participating in them. The first one is about additional outreach, education, and enforcement. So that works really nicely. In addition to the two new officers that we got, we've also been working on a plan for ramping up what those patrols look like, and then how do we work with other partners on education and outreach. And those in partners now also include people like state parks, who are listed on the executive order. The second bullet is about adjusting our fishing season. So we heard about north of Falcon this morning. That was something that that I think will be really important for this year and this interim time before the task force gets up and running, that we're doing some measures to benefit killer whales. And then we need to use the task force process to have further discussions about what does that look like to not affect just our fisheries, but all of the users and the places that are important for killer whales. Next, the order asked us to look at the fish food that goes into our hatcheries, the idea being that if we know that contaminants and PCBs in particular are harmful to whales, we want to make sure we're not putting them into the fish that we're ramping up production on and negatively impacting them. So we're working on looking at the level of PCBs that currently exist in the food. Is there something we can do to mitigate that, and what would it cost if that does exist? We're looking at our highest priority areas for killer whales and overlapping information that we have on everything from harvest to hatchery operations and habitat restoration to be able to prioritize and focus where we want to do these actions. And lastly, we're working with others to look at how grants that are supporting Chinook recovery are also going to provide benefits for killer whales. The task force itself is just getting up and running. I believe that the invitation letters went out this week from the governor's office to members, and the first meeting is on May 1st, and the governor's going to come and kick that off himself. The first report is due to the governor by November 2018, and the idea is that any policy direction or funding recommendations that would come from the task force would be integrated into the governor's budget, and then we could discuss it at next full legislative session. The task force has really broad representation from many stakeholder groups, and it's taken quite a while for the steering committee to figure out that structure. The structure includes a crosscut, a core group that is going to be the task force itself, and then three working groups that are going to be focusing on prey, vessels, and toxics and contaminants, so diving into those issues a little bit deeper. The two co-chairs of the task force are Stephanie Soline from Orcas Island and Les Peirce, who lives here in Olympia. The two state leads that have been appointed from the governor are us, WDFW, and Puget Sound Partnership. So we're working with the co-chairs on a steering committee and trying to do as much as possible to support the governor's office in getting this off the ground. And then I'm also focusing a lot of my attention in a special capacity right now in our director's office, working on not just supporting the governor's efforts, but all of the actions that I talked about that DFW is doing right now. As far as participation in the task force, Chair Smith has been asked to serve on the task force itself, as well as Deputy Director Windrup. And then on the working groups, we have Kurt Hughes on the prey group, Jim West on the toxics group, and then Captain Alan Myers will be on the vessel group. So we'll be well represented there. And with that, I'll take any questions that you might have.
Commissioners?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions of the presentation, but I do want to offer a few thoughts to the commission with regard to policy guidance that might come from us to help out on this, with particular reference to the hatchery component of this. So if there are questions, I think maybe I should wait in case there are questions of the presentation.
I just have a quick one, Penny. PCBs, I never, how are they getting in the fish food?
I don't know a lot about this topic. However, I understand that they're fairly ubiquitous. And from what I hear from some of our hatchery folks right now that are doing the research, I think it's quite difficult to find a source of protein that doesn't have some level of PCBs in the environment. But I can certainly follow up and give you some more detailed information.
That's a protein, yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Okay, well, go for it.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This recommendation will be for the commission to really provide for some strong guidance to the staff to work hard to comply with the executive order's intent for exploring increases in hatchery production. You may recall last December when I mentioned that I'd been to a meeting with Ron Warren with the National Marine Fisheries Service folks, who were talking about a biological opinion on killer whales and whether or not they might end up with a jeopardy or a no jeopardy conclusion. And looking at the same information here, they were talking about needing the mitigative factor of some increased hatchery production to get to a no jeopardy call. That was some maybe casual discussion at that time, but there was a lot of important people in the meeting. So we've got an executive order talking about trying to do more for prey, Chinook salmon as prey. We've got the National Marine Fisheries Service talking about the same thing. And in the immediate actions in the executive order, there are a few things to try to do by April 30th. There are some things that kind of already are done. There was mention here of some budget help for hatchery production. It's relatively small. It involves just a couple of facilities, and I think that quite a bit more has to be done if we're going to really enhance the food source of Chinook salmon for the orca. By April 30th, there's a few things that need to be done. The important one here that I see is it says that by July 31st, 2018, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, in conjunction with the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office and the Puget Sound Partnership, shall identify highest priority areas and watersheds for southern resident prey, Chinook salmon, in order to focus or adjust as needed, and it lists a variety of things. I'll pick out of the list hatchery programs. So, in order to focus or adjust as needed, increases in hatchery programs. So if you could flip to the graph at the beginning of the abundance of killer whales, I was able to take a look at the Puget Sound, that one right there, yeah, the Puget Sound hatchery releases and what they have done over this time frame. And back, it's difficult to look at this axis here of 100 to 60, that is for the numbers of killer whales. But if you presume for a moment that that stands for millions of smolts released in Puget Sound, in the late 80s, it was around 50. So it's off, it's down below the graph here. In 1989, it was up to 80. So that would be in this area here. Now we are down at 40. Oops, it's off the table again. So the trend in hatchery production in Puget Sound, millions of smolts, is straight down during this time when the killer whales aren't doing too good either. We saw on the graph that the killer whales spend some time off the Washington coast, particularly off the mouth of the Columbia River, during that May time frame when a lot of Columbia River stocks, notably Cowlett Spring Chinook and Lower River Hatchery Fall Chinook, reside. In addition, of course, all of the spring and summer runs that are migrating back to the Columbia River are in that area. So maybe it's no surprise that the killer whales like to go there that time of year. But in terms of hatchery production, I think that means that the Columbia River facilities should be involved in the hatchery production business as well. So where I'm going with this is I'm suggesting that the commission urge the staff to be very aggressive in their thinking about where tens of millions of additional Chinook ought to be released for hatchery production that can benefit killer whales. This involves looking at areas where you don't want to cause problems with wild fish. And so the area-by-area search needs to look for places where there's going to be able to be terminal area fisheries that aren't going to cause problems for wild fish. And I know there's already been some thinking about this, and there's been some really good thinking about this, but we'd just like to encourage that there to be more of that. I'd encourage the staff to work with the state of Oregon, where there are some vacancies in their Willamette Spring Chinook hatchery programs. And Willamette Spring Chinook, of course, would be returning to the time and area where the killer whales are in the spring months, and they also parallel some of the migration patterns there. So in the Columbia River, not to just think about the Washington side, but also talking to the Oregon folks. Again, this is a thought of, well, I'll use the phrase that Mr. Holzmiller has used before, of increasing the pie. Since we're talking about killer whales eating things, maybe pie is a good analogy here. But for the staff to go river by river in the Columbia River, facility by facility in the Columbia River, where there are vacant capacity now, and look at recommendations for, again, large numbers of Chinook salmon to be released. And in Puget Sound, where there are areas that maybe innovative programs can be released in, I'll call it a dead-end bay, where whenever the fish mature and come back to a dead-end bay, there can be a fishery that reduces the strays to wild areas. And so it's a very important matter that has a tangential benefit to fisheries. I don't want to hide behind that and put that right there on the table. If there are more Chinook salmon released for killer whales and they're marked hatchery fish, there's going to be opportunities for catching fish as well. So, I mean, it could be a positive in several different directions. There has to be caution with regard to where all this occurs, but also to consider what kind of fisheries ought to be in play to help on all of that. So, Mr. Chairman, I see that you're on the task force there. There's a lot of things the task force is dealing with. I'm just talking about the hatchery component part of this, and I'd be willing to help in that and working with the staff and the governor's office to try to optimize this as much as possible. I know that when you start talking about tens of millions of additional hatchery fish, people are going to say something about the money. And once again, I would encourage that the thinking be free on this in terms of where to go, and then think about the money. Think about the optimal areas. Think about the maximum number of fish that can be released, and to approach the federal government, who also has to consider what to do about achieving a no jeopardy call on killer whales, and also to consider approaching the governor again, or making a proposal that might come from here for additional money just for this purpose. And so while there will be a cost to this, I would suggest that the pursuit does not let money be a stopper at this early point. So all in all, again, it's a recommendation that this commission endorse a rather aggressive approach to put a lot more Chinook salmon in the areas where these killer whales are. When these other alternatives are talked about, reducing fisheries, it's been mentioned that the North of Falcon folks did take a look at that and squeezed that where they could. There's not a lot of squeeze that's going to result in a lot of fish for killer whales. We heard Mr. Anderson give us a briefing in Ridgefield about how much fisheries have been reduced since this, since the time of the Pacific Salmon Treaty, and it's very, very dramatic. And the kind of reductions in fisheries right now that can be done are not going to produce a lot of Chinook salmon for prey. Some of these longer-term matters, habitat fixes and the rest of that, are going to take years. Wild fish recovery is a long-term thing. That's not going to be a big change in the number of Chinook salmon available for prey for killer whales if you're looking at some of these wild populations to increase. Some of these rebuilding time frames are looking at are 50, 70 years to get back to spawning escapement goals. So I think the opportunities here to do the best thing for killer whale prey of Chinook salmon is in this area of hatchery production.
Thank you, Commissioner. And yeah, we're just beginning the fight. So I great input. Did you have anything else, Patty?
Yeah, Chair Smith, Commissioner McIsaac, I just wanted to explain that I think your direction is consistent with some of the direction we got through the legislative language, which came with the money that we got for hatchery increases, which asked us to develop a plan, a future plan for hatchery increases by the end of 2018. So the analyses that you're talking about urging us to do are exactly, I think, what we intend to do with the participation of our co-managers, and then certainly bringing in ODF&W and others, as you suggest. So, yeah, we're very much aligned. And
that's a good role for the commission to you know, weigh in heavily in this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was that? Okay, well, I'm honored to be working with you and Deputy Director Amy on this. So I look forward to as it progresses. And thank you for your leadership in all of this. And that's a good PowerPoint. There's a lot of education in that. So I think how we get, you know, you tweak it a little bit, but that should get into K-12, you know, colleges, on and on. Because there's that takes a whole lot of history and crunches it into a short period of time that I think the part of the education and outreach is already right there. So we will talk. And that brings us to closure for Friday the 13th. So we will recess until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in this